Okay, so we are in 1 Kings chapter 12, and we've reached the point now where we're going to be in 1 Kings exclusively for a while, meaning 1 Kings not following along as well in 2 Chronicles. As we mentioned last week, from the point where we are now, 2 Chronicles is going to primarily be following the history of the kings of Judah, whereas 1 Kings and then on into 2 Kings is going to concentrate primarily on the history of the kings of Israel, now that we have a division in the kingdom. And so for the next few chapters, we're going to be following the history that God preserves or records for the reign of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, over Israel. And that material is not covered in 2 Chronicles. So we will be finishing up chapter 12, Lord willing, here in 1 Kings, and go on into chapter 13, and most of, or at least half of chapter, probably two-thirds of chapter 14, before we're going to have some of 2 Chronicles to go back to look at. So we'll be here in 1 Kings, the book of 1 Kings for a bit, Lord willing. But to catch us up from where we are to where we are in our study, now the beginning of the physical nation of Israel, who would we start that with? Who's the father of the nation? Let's go with Abraham there. That's good. So Abraham, of course, then Isaac was the son of the promise. It was not Ishmael. And then with Isaac, it was his son, the younger of the twins, Jacob, not Esau. This was the line that God chose to fulfill the blessings that he promised. He made those promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that he would make of him that nation that would be like the stars in the sky and the sand of the sea for multitude. Then he was going to give them the land of Canaan for an inheritance. And of course, ultimately, he was going to bring his son, Jesus Christ, through their descendants. All right, so we had Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then, of course, from Jacob, he had the 12 sons that became the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel. All right, then as far as the leadership, the book of Genesis records all of this to where we have the beginning of the 12 tribes. They end up going down into Egypt to sojourn there, according to what God had foretold when he spoke to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 15. How long were they going to be in Egypt? 400 years. Of course, he didn't name Egypt as being that nation where they would sojourn, but later in the book of Genesis, that's where they go. And the book of Genesis ends with Jacob and his 12 sons, and the children that they had up to that point, and wives, all of that in total at the close of the book of Genesis, when the family is all together in that land of Goshen in Egypt during Joseph's days, and of course Jacob then dies, but that happens at the very end of the book of Genesis. But at the time they enter into Egypt, the whole family, and begin their sojourn there, how many souls were they? 70. So we have 70 souls in Egypt to start with. Then we get to the book of Exodus, where we begin right away, and those 70 souls have now multiplied to the point where God has fulfilled the promise as concerning their numbers, and they had become so numerous that the Egyptians were concerned about being taken over by the Israelites that were in their midst, those Hebrews. And so that's when they made a law that the Hebrew children were to any males, what were to happen to any males that were born of them? I mean, they were going to kill their children, yeah. And so that was how Moses ended up being put in that little ark and put out on the river. And then he was found by Pharaoh's daughter, brought up in the house of Pharaoh, but of course he forsook all that and was made the first judge of Israel. So that's where Exodus is, where we have the number, but they're still in bondage in Egypt. They have to come out of Egypt to go to Canaan. So that's what the book of Exodus is about, the beginning of all of that. So that is now that the tribes have become a nation, and that nation is born when they leave Egypt. That was the Exodus under Moses, as they are then, well, they have the 40-year sojourn in the wilderness on the way to Canaan, but then it was Joshua that led them into Canaan. But there we have the leadership of the nation after they become a nation, and it starts with, and what was the form of government? They had judges. That's what God had chosen for them. And we've already mentioned the first two there, Moses and Joshua. But Moses through, who was the last of the judges? Samuel, who was also a prophet, of course. So you had that, the judges from the time they, well, left Egypt as a nation under Moses, and then Joshua, who led them into Canaan, conquered Canaan, and they remained under judges for the next 400 years. Until after, at the end of Solomon's life, when he was old, Israel demanded to have a king, like all the nations around them. Something that God had foreseen and even mentioned in the book of Deuteronomy back in Moses' time, that was going to happen, that they would demand a king, and said what, that he gave certain laws for their kings. So that was foreseen by God, foretold by God, and it came to pass. And so the 12 tribes were under the kings then after the judges. And the 12 tribes were ruled over by which three kings? Who was the first king? Saul. And then we had David, which that was significant because it was a change, not just in from one king to another, but it was a change in house, which house was ruling over Israel as king, in a different tribe. So the house of Saul, of the tribe of Benjamin, that was over after Saul. And so David was, of course, of the tribe of Judah. That being very important because that fulfilled prophecy going back to Jacob's time that Judah would be the royal tribe in Israel. As Jacob had foretold in Genesis 49, that the scepter, and that is symbolic of the kings, that's what the kings hold, the scepter would not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. So there was a prophecy there of Christ, that Judah would be the royal tribe and the ultimate lawgiver for Israel. Then the ultimate king of kings was going to come through the tribe of Judah, through that royal line that was established by David. And then that continued through his son Solomon. But this brings us to the point where we are now, because we have a division in the kingdom of the tribes of Israel now. So we no longer have all 12 together under one king. We now have a split, and we have 10 of the tribes. And then we have Judah plus Benjamin over here. And we have Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that's ruling over, that is made king over these 10. And we have Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, that's made king over, to continue that throne of David that was going to be preserved by God because of David's righteousness and obedience to God, and also to fulfill those prophecies and God's promises concerning Christ his son. So there was, that was very important to preserve that over here. But Jeroboam is the beginning of the kings of the 10 tribes of the north. Jeroboam was of which tribe? Ephraim, and he was the chief of the house of Joseph under King Solomon. That's where he got that position by God, obviously, as God raised him up to be an adversary to Solomon to make all this happen. Because of Solomon's turning to idols, and then the people of Israel following suit. So this was fulfillment of all of that. And where we've read up to this point in 1 Kings chapter 12, after Solomon's death, Rehoboam, they gather in Shechem, which is in Ephraim. And there Rehoboam was to be made king of Israel, but the people of Israel demanded that their burden be lightened in order for them to be willing to serve Rehoboam. He was counseled by the older men, the ones that had been the wise men under Solomon. So there you would have had a collection of what should have been probably all time some of the most wise men to listen to as far as advice for a matter like that. And they gave good counsel, told him to be agreeable to the people and be willing to be their servant to speak softly to them. Well, he didn't like that, so he goes to the young man he was brought up with. What should I say? Well, you tell them, my father chastised you with whips, I'll chastise you with scorpions, and all those other hard words. And that's what he said. And so what did these 10 tribes say? To your tents, O Israel, what part do we have in David? They split off, and then they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat to be their king. He was there as their leader for that time when they were gathered to make Rehoboam king. They had called him to be there. I mean, he was the chief of the house of Joseph under Solomon. The house of Joseph, that includes the tribe of Ephraim, the half-tribe of, it was really two tribes, but became two separate tribes in terms of inheritance. But that was Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph. But as one house, I mean, that was the dominant tribe of the north. Ephraim was in its population particularly, but Manasseh wasn't small. And you combine those of the house of Joseph, I mean, that was by far a dominant in Israel, the only rival to that as far as one tribe would be Judah in the south. So that put Jeroboam in a very high position, really as the chief leader of any of those tribes in the north, and they made him their king. Well, Rehoboam, when that happened, Rehoboam sends out his tax collector. So even though they say they're not going to follow him, he said, well, we'll see about that. Sends his tax collector to take their money. What do they do with him? They killed him. So they murdered the king's tax collector. So this establishes absolutely a split in the kingdom. So Rehoboam starts to gather his army together of Judah and Benjamin to go and fight a war to bring the other tribes into submission under him. And what did God say? Forbade him from doing it because he said, this thing is from me. That's verse 24 here in 1 Kings 12. So God said, this is from me, don't go fight. If he had not listened to that, would he have succeeded or failed? He obviously would have failed. We even noted a couple of examples from Israel's history when there were similar type events and where the people didn't listen and tried to go and force things anyway. What always happens when we try to force things to be our way, when God has a different plan in mind? Who always prevails? God does. Now, can we, if we're seeking the Lord and we pray to God, is God willing to hear our prayers and is it possible for God to change his mind about things? And is he willing to do that? Yeah, that's one reason he asks us to pray. Now, sometimes we might look at that and maybe we might be better off sometimes just letting it go his way anyway. One example comes to mind with Moses. God was ready to wipe out all those evil people, that wicked generation that came out of Egypt, was going to start over with Moses and Joshua and Caleb and make a new nation out of them. Moses pled that God wouldn't do that and to spare the people. So God listened, but then what did that mean? It ended up happening God's way in the end, but it just with 40 years of wandering in the wilderness until they all died out from plagues or other for other reasons. And then God brought the next generation in. So, God knew the hearts of those people. But that was a good thing. Moses showed his love for God and for the people and his humility and meekness in pleading for them. And God heard that. So there was nothing wrong with what Moses prayed there. But God heard that. But then you can think about it. That would have spared Moses a whole lot of trouble if God had started over with him right then and there, wouldn't it? But anyway, that happens sometimes. But God does desire us to pray. But when God has, when He's made His determination the way things are going to be, it's going to be that way. But He made that clear to Rehoboam here and said, "Don't go and fight. This thing is for Me." And it says at the very end of verse 24 that they hearkened therefore to the word of the Lord and returned to depart according to the word of the Lord. All right, so that brings us up to verse 25. So now we're caught up after this lengthy review going back to Genesis. So we've covered Genesis and Exodus and 1 Kings. So here we are, verse 25. Let's go ahead and read here from 1 Kings chapter 12. Verses 25 and through 27. Let's see, Brother Tom, can you read that for us?
Then Jericho built Shechem in Mount Ephraim, and dwelt therein, and went out from thence, and built Penuel. And Jericho said in his heart, "Now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. If this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then shall the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam, the king of Judah. And they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam, king of Judah."
Okay, so the first thing that Jeroboam does after he's made king over those 10 tribes in the north, it says that he built Shechem in Mount Ephraim and dwelt therein. So he makes his capital, which he chooses Shechem. Now Shechem was the place that was obviously, well, that was the place where they gathered in verse 1 of this chapter to make Rehoboam king. One could ask, well, why would they gather in Shechem? Why would that be the place where they would go? Why not Jerusalem? Because that was the capital of the nation, made so by David as the city of David. Why did they go to Shechem to make Rehoboam king? Well, what would geographically would there be any? Would that make any sense, or would there be any logic to choosing that location to gather for the whole nation to come and gather there? Well, what about where are we right now? We're in Columbia, South Carolina. Well, Columbia, I think probably all of us. Well, there some of us weren't raised here that are in the room, and if you never took South Carolina history or learned about that, South Carolina is the only planned capital in the United States other than Washington, D.C. itself. Columbia was pre-chosen as a site to become the capital. It used to be Charleston, but there was no Columbia here. At that time, but it was decided to make a new capital, and then they chose this location. Well, you got two rivers coming together to form another, the Broad and the Saluda, to form the Congaree. So you got three rivers right here, and what else is it? What's special about Columbia besides the rivers there for the state of South Carolina? We're right in the dead center. So they chose, that's the reason this place was chosen. Then it was a planned capital. That's why the streets downtown, they're perfect square blocks in the very downtown area. But that, it was a planned city, like Washington, D.C. was a planned city for the nation's capital. So we have a unique history like that. How does that tie into this? It was chosen as a central location. It makes sense. And when you're in a place like in an area, choose a central location for, make it convenient for everybody in this case, in the state, to come for their the governmental business and that sort of thing. Well, where was Shechem geographically in Israel? In Mount Ephraim. I mean, that's really the center of the country, of the nation and their territory. So, that would make sense for a gathering place. But it happens to be in Ephraim, big territory, which is also the home tribe of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. So now that he becomes king, he makes that his capital. That also makes sense. He makes the capital in the territory of the tribe that he belongs to. So he builds Shechem. When we were in verse 1, we took that opportunity. We don't want to just read a name and just move on. A lot of these places, they have... there's historical significance in God's Word about those places. And at the time we started the study of chapter 12 here in 1 Kings, we reviewed a little bit of that regarding Shechem. Shechem's history goes way back into the book of Genesis. That happened to be the place where Levi and Simeon, the two sons of Jacob, went and destroyed the people of Shechem. Because of the dishonor that was done to their sister Diana. Well, the fact that they went and performed that slaughter there in a rage, was that something good for them? No, in fact, that led to the prophecy in Genesis 49 of them because of their what they did in that situation in their anger, that God said that their descendants would be scattered in Israel. They would not have their own separate territory. So in the case of Simeon, they were given cities amongst the territory of Judah. But the Levites were given cities. In their case, the cities for the Levites, the priestly cities that were around Israel, because that also served the purpose for establishing the priests and throughout the land of Israel to be the ones to teach the people His word. So God had so there was a bad part for Levi, but then a good part as God rewarded him because of his fear of the Lord. So Levi's story had a lot of good to it, especially the end point of that. So God even turned something that was a punishment to start with into something that was actually a blessing for the whole nation later as a reward for His goodness. So anyway, that was the where we first read about Shechem in the scriptures in its history, and that also was a place of rebellion, as we noted back in Judges chapter 9, Gideon's son, Ahimelech, was the one that wanted to become king in Israel after Gideon's death, and that was the city where his mother was from, and so he got the people of Shechem to back him, and then he killed all of his brothers and made himself king until God brought that to an end as he heard the curse of Gideon's lone surviving son that escaped the slaughter, who made that curse that God would destroy the people of Shechem and his half-brother that did all of that evil. And God did bring that to pass and turned them against each other. So Shechem was the scene of the first attempt in a rebellion against God to try to make a king, when that was not God's will. So it had a prior history of being a site of a time when there was division in Israel and some things happening. So that was like that, and so it's kind of interesting to see it coming up again in this way, where this is where the kingdom is divided. It was the location where that occurred, the division in the kingdom that was going to endure for the rest of Israel's history, and then becomes the very capital of the king, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Well, that's Shechem, but he builds that, makes sense, makes that his capital there, verse 25. But he also had a prominent city that he built, and that's Penuel. Now, Penuel should ring some bells, too, when we hear that name. That there's some very significant events that, at least a couple of them, similar to Shechem. Shechem, we had the first notable event that was there in the book of Genesis, and the next one there was in the book of Judges. Well, guess what? Same thing with Penuel. What's the first thing that we read about of Penuel in Scripture? Well, it's in Genesis chapter 32. What happened there? That's the place where Jacob wrestled the angel. So that was Peniel. So if you just make a note of Genesis 32, that was there. Well, then it also comes up later in the book of Judges, again associated with Gideon. In this case, it was during Gideon's lifetime. During the what is Gideon famous for? What did he do at the time when he became judge of Israel? Well, to be their judge, God would raise up the judge to first deliver them from whatever enemy was oppressing them, and then he would serve as a judge, and the people would follow the Lord during their time, which they did. But Gideon's start was in being raised up to be the one that God used to deliver them from their oppressor, and in his time, who was that? Those were the Midianites. And so Gideon had his army of how many? 300 that defeated them. Why so few? God wanted it to be absolutely clear to everybody that that was God that did that, not men. And so after it was all over, with that obvious demonstration that this was of God and not men, what did the people of Israel do? They wanted to make Gideon king to reward him for the victory. So that wasn't very good, was it? But when he defeated the Midianites, they were destroyed, but they had their two kings, Zeba and Zalmunna, that had fled with their remnant, and Gideon pursued after them. He asked, as he and his men, they'd been fighting all night. They were hungry and thirsty in pursuit of their enemies. And so they came to, there are two cities in Judges chapter 8 that were very prominent in their cowardice, their lack of faith. Where Gideon went as he was chasing the Midianites, Succoth and then Peniel. And when he went to those places to ask help of his brethren, as he's fighting their enemies, what do? They say no. They won't help him. They won't give him any food or water. What's the reason? Because they don't believe. They don't have faith in God and what he was doing through Gideon. And in their minds, they're afraid of... They think Gideon's going to lose, and then they'll have to answer to the Midianites for it. Well, they were wrong. And, of course, Gideon and God's people prevailed. And so then Peniel... And this has some echoes of what happens now in 1 Kings chapter 12 also. Because the people of Peniel, they were, in their minds, the way that they were going to come up with to try to secure themselves was to continue to help the Midianites and not help Gideon. So instead, they did the opposite of what they should have done. If they wanted to have safety, well, who should they depend upon? The only one who can provide that, and that's God. Well, then you have to do the will of God. And in this case, what would be the will of God? To help their brother who's fighting their enemies. But they decide, well, the best way they're going to have their security is to do it their way, the opposite of God's way, and then to refuse to help Gideon so that they will then have the favor of the Midianites. So how did it end up? Well, of course, Gideon prevailed over the Midianites, and he came back to Peniel, and they had their tower. And what did he do with it? He did with it exactly what he told them he was going to do when they refused to help him. He said he was going to come back and he was going to destroy that tower of theirs. And he came back, and in Judges chapter 8, verse 17, he beat down the tower of Peniel and slew the men of the city. So that's what happened to Peniel back then. Well, here now Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, is building Peniel at the time when Jeroboam is about to do something almost exactly the same. Well, in essence, it is exactly the same as what the people of Peniel did back at this time in Gideon's time. God has made a promise to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, about how to make his throne secure. And that is by doing the will of God. If he would follow the Lord and obey him like David did, God promised that he would secure his throne like he secured David's. And he doesn't believe that. And so he's going to come up with his own plan to secure his throne. And what's it going to end up doing? It's going to cause his throne to be insecure. It's going to cause the destruction of his house. By not doing it God's way, but trying to do it his own way. So he builds up Shechem, makes that his capital, builds Penuel, so he's making that one of his strong cities. But unfortunately, he's going to be walking in the footsteps of the men of Penuel from Gideon's time. The next thing he's going to do, as we read in verse 26, he says in his heart, "Now shall the kingdom return to the house of David." Well, there's the first problem. He's saying in his heart, here's what's going to happen. He's thinking on his own. This is an example of someone leaning to their own understanding. He's now become king. He's made his capital. He's built his strong city, Penuel. Now he's thinking about the security of his kingdom. Well, to think about, well, all right, I want to be king. I want to have my throne secure and then be able to reign. As a new king, that part of it, to consider, what do I need to do to have a secure throne? That in and of itself, is that a bad thought? Well, no, not if it's related to the overall thought, or as part of the overall thought of how can I serve the Lord? Now, for David, that was the only consideration. So everything David had in mind as far as reigning as a king was a subset or secondary or part of his loving God and serving God with all of his heart, soul, mind, and strength. So being king was the way that God gave him to do that service to him, or one of the main ways. Every thought that David had about his kingdom was in regard to that. Well, that's the way we should all be in our lives. Should there be any separation between our serving God and any other part of our lives? Is there a separate compartment? Do we have how we serve God, and what kind of an American citizen are we? Or what our career is? Or what our role in his church is? Or anything like that? And our families? So when we think of our any of those, and people have their categories of their life that they think about, but for us, there's really one, there should be, and everything is part of that. Everything else is part of that. But there should not be any separation between our serving God and any of those other aspects of our life. It all should be part of that. That's what, in fact, our next hour, we'll get to consider that as far as what our purpose is in loving and seeking God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. Galatians 2:20, Paul was crucified with Christ. He said, "I'm crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live." But he said, "Yet not I, but Christ liveth in me." And the life that he was now living in the flesh, he was living by the faith of the Son of God, the one who loved him and gave himself for him. So Paul had only one kind of life, the same kind that he mentions in Colossians 3 in the first three verses there. If you be risen with Christ, set your affection on the things above, not on the things on the earth. And he says, "For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God." So as far as having whatever the life of John Macon, we'll just use me as an example, but it's the same for you, for all of us. My life as me ended a long time ago. And never to exist again. if I'm going to belong to the Lord. But we all had that point. When we made the decision, and we all have to make that decision, whether we're going to live for our Maker or not. And choosing to live for our Maker means we don't have a life otherwise. We have no other type of life. There is no us anymore. The only thing we are is we're an instrument of God to use Christ to live in us. That's it. So we shouldn't exist anymore. We're dead. Our life is now hidden with Christ in God. So the role that God has for me and my family, the work that I have to do, my job, my everything, all parts of that are a function of, well, how is Christ living in me? And that needs to be every second of my existence in yours, all of us. That's the way it has to be. We belong to Him. And there cannot be any separation of that. Well, we're going to serve God over here, but now over here, what do I want for my career? What are my career goals for me? No, I can't think like that. Any aspect of my career is, well, how does that tie into my service to God? We have to think that way. And that's the way David thought with his being king. He didn't think about being king for himself. He didn't think about king and being king and what that meant for his own power, what that meant for his own wealth, what that meant for what he could do for himself in that position. Now, people that have power in this world or have wealth in this world, how many of them think about that? I mean, look at people in... Look at... God appoints the leaders of our nation, our government, and they are His ministers in that. They, with very few exceptions, they don't recognize who put them there and who's using them to do what they're doing. As far as their own minds are concerned, how many people that are in leaders and have power in government actually are thinking exclusively about how to serve the people in their position and have no thoughts about what using their own power for themselves and having their wealth for themselves. And I mean, sadly, it's a rare thing, it seems. Very rare. Well, they'll all answer for how they handle the position that God has given them. But David is king. Where do we ever see anything like that? And David completely depended upon God for the security of his throne, and he understood that there was one and only one way for his throne to be secure, and that was the way that God promised to make it such. And that was by David obeying the Lord. And consequently, David knew that if he obeyed the Lord, he had nothing else to worry about concerning his throne. Such that he could even make a covenant with the heir to the throne that he was now taking, and have his best friend to be Jonathan, the son of Saul, the one whose throne that God was taking from the house of Saul, from Jonathan specifically. Who would have been the next king of Israel had it not been David, if it had just gone by the way things go with kings? It would have been Jonathan, David's best friend. Their hearts were knit together by their faith in God. But what goal? And look at Jonathan in his life. Did Jonathan have the goal to be king of Israel? We don't ever read anything about that was Jonathan's goal. Jonathan wasn't living in this world to have his life for himself. His life was strictly to serve God, and he understood it was not God's will for him to ever be king of Israel. And when he understood it was not God's will for him to do that, but rather it was God's will for David to be the king of Israel, what was Jonathan's view of that? God's will be done. He was going to still serve God to the best of his ability and even help the one that God had chosen to be king instead of himself. And he said, when you're king, I'll be at your right hand. He says, that also my father knows. Such that Saul even threw a javelin to kill Jonathan, his son, because Jonathan was not going to try to cooperate with Saul in securing that throne of Israel in the house of Saul, Jonathan knew that would have been futile. And it would have been to his own destruction to have done that. He didn't think like that. David didn't think like that. Jonathan didn't think like that. In fact, if David hadn't been king of Israel, who in that time would have been a better king of Israel than Jonathan? But it wasn't God's will for the reasons that we know. And so Jonathan helped David, and David made a covenant with Jonathan. And of course, it was not God's will that Jonathan remain alive at the time of David being made king. He died the same day that Saul, his father, did, and that's when David was anointed king over Judah at first. Well, there still was a war in Israel between those who are of the house of Saul and then David and his house for 7 years. Until the house of Saul was defeated and David was made anointed king over all the tribes of Israel. David had no thought of doing anything for his own to secure himself. And who did he bring in to eat at his table as one of his own sons? But Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth, to keep the covenant that he'd made with Jonathan. And as we pointed out, what... Do you know of another example in history of somebody who was king that would bring in to be as part of his own family what would have been the chief rival for his own throne? In any other situation, that would have been person number one on a hit list to be murdered. But not with David, because David knew, how was that going to secure his throne? That would have insecured his throne by breaking his covenant that he made with Jonathan if he had done harm to Mephibosheth remembered that covenant. God would have turned on David for that. But David was a man after God's own heart. He knew that his throne was going to be utterly secure. It didn't bother him to even bring in what would have been the heir to the throne if he were not occupying that throne and have him as part of his own family. So that was David. And every decision he made, remember when he became king over all the tribes of Israel, what was the very first act that David performed as king of all Israel? He went up and fought the city of the Jebusites, Jerusalem. And he conquered that city, drove out those ones who had occupied it for the entire history of Israel. That was a blight on Israel and their record of their lack of faith in obeying the command of God to drive out their enemies. Well, that was right there. They were right there and David was responsible now as king. And the first thing he does is drive them out, makes that his city, the city of David. And then from there, I'm going to make this the city for my dwelling place, but then to be the place where this will be the center of Israel, not just as the political capital, but as really the spiritual capital, as he was going to restore the worship of God because there hadn't been a tabernacle going back to before Saul's time. It had been destroyed, that one that had been at Shiloh. The Ark of the Covenant didn't have its permanent dwelling place. And that's the next thing David does. He conquers Jerusalem. Then he brings in the Ark of the Covenant, puts it there with God's authorization to have that to be the new place for there to be a temple built. And then everything else in his reign, he's preparing for that. Every decision David made, it was all about what was good for God and the people of Israel to be able to serve God like God wanted. And there was no thoughts of anything for himself. Well, if Jeroboam was thinking about, how can I make my kingdom secure by following the Lord so that my life is a glory to Him and so that I'm ruling over the people in righteousness to help them to follow their God. That was David's only goal as being king. And even Solomon, when he becomes king, when God asks him what he would desire, he wanted a wise and understanding heart to judge the people of Israel so he could use that position that God gave him to be able to lead the people righteously. obviously had learned that from his father. Now later he forgot that for a time, late in his life, but repented. But there's still consequences, which we're seeing now. But Jeroboam is not thinking that way at all. When he's thinking about making his throne secure, it's for himself. He's thinking about being king, what it means to himself. Is there any thought of God at all in this? Jeroboam's not thinking about God at all. Even though he was already told back in chapter 11, when Ahijah the prophet came to him and told him, if you will follow the Lord like David did, then God's going to make your throne secure like he made David's. He has not only those words, he has the example. Because at that very time, God told him through that same prophet, you can't rule over Judah because I'm preserving that for David's sake. So he has the example of it as well as the promise. He didn't believe that. So now he's thinking, okay, now will the kingdom return to the house of David. Now, if his actual thought was, what can I do to make sure that I lose my throne? What we start reading from verse 27 down would be the exact answer to how to do that. If his thought had been, what can I do to make sure that I fail as king and I make sure that I don't that I have no posterity to rule over Israel with, so that I'm a that my throne is a very brief one. What can I possibly do to destroy my family and my throne and all this? Well, if that had been his thought, what he comes up with here is would have been exactly the way to make that happen. That is what's going to happen, but he's thinking the opposite. He's saying, what can I do to make my throne secure so that the people don't go and follow David and kill me? He's going to now set up a new religion for Israel. For the express purpose of securing his throne, but in fact it's going to destroy his kingdom. So, verse 26, Jeroboam said in his heart, now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. Well, he was actually right about that, in a sense. Of course, it's not God's will for the kingdom to be reunited only under Rehoboam. That part he's wrong in. But as far as his thinking that his throne was going to be insecure, he was right that it was going to be, but he's going to be the one to make it happen, make that so, by not listening to God and following him. So he's going to take counsel in verse 28. So Rehoboam listened to some unwise counsel. Jeroboam's going to have some people to give him some advice of how to make sure that his people, Jeroboam's people, aren't close to Rehoboam. He's going to try to literally sever the ties and separate his people from the rival kingdom now. We'll go into the details of that, Lord willing, next time. But read through the end of chapter 12 and see all the different things that Jeroboam does. But an interesting question to look at as you go through that. Ask, where in God's Word, where in the Law of Moses particular, did God specifically say that Jeroboam or anybody else should not or could not do the things that he did? It's interesting, because if you go, between now and next week, if you go ahead and read Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Search for the place. First read the end of 1 Kings 12. Then go back and read all the Law of Moses and search for the places where God specifically said that nobody was to do what he's going to do here. You won't find it. Now what you will find when you read all that is God's going to say what they were supposed to do, and he gave his commandment of what was right. And the problem is Jeroboam is going to do something different than what God had authorized. But if you're going to look for where God said specifically, don't make a feast on this day, don't build an altar in this place, don't make priests of this people of this tribe, if you're looking for that, you're not going to find it like that. But God says who could be, when their feasts were to be, where the altar was to be, who was to be priest. And when God says here's the way it is to be, that eliminates anything else. So he's going to do a slew of things that God hadn't authorized. And it's sin. But there's a big lesson to learn from that principle too. But anyway, think about all that and do some studying on that between now and next Sunday morning. And Lord willing, we'll go over that at that time.